And our third speaker tonight for the Leave side of the proposition, please welcome Conservative member of the European Parliament, Daniel Hannan.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm inviting you to make me redundant. And indeed, in the bargain, make Nigel redundant. And I wouldn't be doing that if I were not confident that there will be plenty of openings for newly unemployed MEPs in the boom that will come to this country after we've left the European Union. And I'll tell you why I am so confident about that prediction. If I put it in one word, it would be obsolete. We just heard from Chucker that these are not the 1950s. He said it as though he was imparting an original insight. Absolutely, these are not the 1950s. And that's why we have outgrown a top-down, dirigiste construct, a hangover of an age when freight costs were high and refrigeration was expensive and regional trade blocs looked like the future. But my friends, that world has been made completely redundant by technological advance. This is an age of the internet, of cheap flights, of Skype. It's as easy to do business with a company in New Zealand as with a company in France. In fact, easier, because the Kiwi company will be English-speaking and common law. Never before has geographical proximity been as irrelevant as now. So why? Why do we tie ourselves to the one part of the world that is not experiencing significant economic growth? Over the last 10 years, China's economy has doubled in size, India's economy has doubled in size, Ethiopia's economy has doubled in size, but the Eurozone, incredibly, was the same size at the end of last year as it had been in 2006. Every continent on this planet has grown over the past decade, except Antarctica and Europe. Now, we are a trading people, we're a maritime people, a people connected by language and law, by habit and history, by commerce and migration to every continent and archipelago. We don't sit on great natural resources here. We have to make our way in the world by what we buy and sell. That means we have to be where the customers are. And as long as we're in the European Union, we cannot sign independent trade agreements with non-EU countries. The EU deal with Australia is being held up because some Italian tomato growers are currently challenging it. The EU deal with Canada is being held up because of an unrelated dispute about Romanian visas. How have we put ourselves in a position where we can't do those deals? Liz cited a few of the big international quangos and the Davos men who tell us that it's in our interest to stay. She said there's nothing in it for the little guy. Well, let me cite a couple of people who are leaders of the Remain campaign. Paddy Ashdown says, if we leave, it'll mean cheaper food. And Lord Rose says, if we leave, it'll mean higher wages. Now, I would have thought that if Liz is really interested in the interests of the working people that she says she's speaking for, she would give more weight to those opinions than to those of the tax-free, Michelin-starred international quangocrats who she sees as the arbiters of our national interest. Why are we paying to belong to the world's only stagnant customs union? Paying £19 billion gross, £11 billion net every year, right? To put this in context, in the last, we just heard about the cuts and, you know, the Labour MPs were standing against all these coalition reductions. In the last parliament, the 2010 to 2015 parliament, according to the IFS, the entire austerity programme saved £36 billion. Over that lifetime of that same parliament, our gross contribution to the EU was £85 billion. Our net contribution was £42 billion. So even if you insist on taking the net figure, that one clean excision would have wiped out the whole of the austerity programme and still given us enough left over to take a penny off income tax. But it's not just the financial price. It's the democratic price. We fought a civil war in this country to establish the principle that laws should not be passed nor taxes raised except by our own elected representatives. And now supreme legislative and executive power is held not just by people that you didn't vote for, but people that, actually, people who generally owe their position to having just lost elections, like Peter Mandelson and Neil Kinnock and now Jacques Sarkozy. It's only when they've been expressly rejected by their electorates that they are invited to come and legislate for us anyway. Now, look, if the EU were about cooperating, if it were like NATO and all the things that Chuck was saying, No one would have a problem with it, right? You'd have to be insane to be against the idea of working with neighboring countries. Can we take it as read that all of us on this platform, all of you in this room, are in favor of cooperating with our immediate neighbors and allies? The problem is that it presumes to legislate for us, that it wants to take on the attributes and trappings of statehood. No one is talking. I mean, Nick trotted out all the cliches about drawbridges and throwing away keys. No one is talking about isolation. Right? Nowhere else in the world do countries apologize for wanting to live under their own laws. You know, New Zealand is not about to join Australia. And we don't go around saying, oh, these dreadful Australo-skeptics, when are they going to understand that they're a small offshore island clinging to outdated notions of sovereignty, right? Japan is not applying to join China, as far as I'm aware. And people don't say, oh, these bigoted Sino-skeptics, when are they going to get it through their heads that they've lost their empire? It is a natural, healthy thing for a democracy to live under its own laws while trading and cooperating with every other country in the world. We are the fifth largest economy on the planet. We're the fourth military power. We're one of five members of the UN Security Council. How much bigger do we have to be before we have the confidence to raise our eyes to more distant horizons and rediscover that global vocation which we once took for granted?